Welcome to the Booktopia podcast. I'm John Purcell. I'm sitting across from a very excited Holly Ringland, who is coming to talk about her debut novel, The Lost Flowers of Alice Hart, which is one of the most beautiful covers I've ever seen. Yeah. Welcome, Holly.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Well, it's been already a fun morning. we have to give a bit of a warning to listeners. Holly just got off a plane from the UK. So
yeah, it's like 12 hours ago, so bear with me.
this could go anywhere.
It really could. It probably will.
Should we start off with just a little tiny bit about the book? You know, what is about, sort of sell it. Give it
out
there.
God, yeah. Okay, sure.
I mean, I can do it for you.
Okay, I'll try, and then you fix me. Okay. So I think probably in simplest terms, The Lost Flowers of Alice Hart follows the story of 9-year-old Alice after she's sort of taken away from the place where she grows up and goes to live with family that she didn't know existed on a Australian native flower farm. And she learns this language of Australian native flowers from her grandmother as a way to say the things that are too hard to speak. And as an adult, we sort of follow Alice's life as she leaves the flower farm and goes out on her own and sort of learns that if she's ever to have the freedom that she desires from her traumatic childhood, she has to find the courage to possess her own story and the language of her own story rather than any that anybody else gives her or prescribes to her.
Well, I think it did a pretty good job.
Thanks. Okay, great.
I mean, to me, it's an extraordinarily moving book.
Thank you.
And the opening is harrowing, as it's meant to be.
It's harrowing to write.
Yeah, I can imagine. and the kind of weird relief that you get as you move into that second part. But then, it does go off in darker directions again. And, there's always this, all the way through, you've got this this tragedy and trauma just wrapping around these people who have experienced horrible things. And this language of flowers, this way of reaching out and speaking to each other is one way of healing. But you've got an interest in how do you live after these kinds of things. And is that what I want to sort of go back into your background now to see where this this book came from, because it's a personal book and it does sort of reflect some of the things you've done in your in your life. So we start off in Queensland, is that right?
I think probably the simplest way to describe where this book came from is the genesis of the novel is I guess in trauma. I've lived a lot of my life with male perpetrated violence. And I've wanted to be a writer all my life, since I was a baby, sort of literally 3 years old. Mum says that's the first time that I like announced that that's what I would be when I grew up. But the thing about trauma and the shame in particular that goes with suffering sort of violence from somebody else is the shame that you carry, and it is so silencing. So, at three I knew I wanted to write, and I'm so grateful that it has happened, but it's taken until I was sort of 34, I'm 37 now, and it took till I was 34 to put myself in the place where I was gonna sit down and actually give this a go. And what started me off on this path with this novel is I was looking at sort of what happens when what's the relationship between trauma and creative writing? Not journaling, not like expressive writing, but what happens if you deliberately and unflinchingly go to that sore place and draw art from there? What would happen? And Lost Flowers is the result for me.
And the next question is, what happened?
What happened was in my personal experience of being alive, the hardest thing I've ever done, because I had to Without even really realizing that this is what would occur, because I didn't know, but it's sort of like picking a stitch in a jumper. Once you pull that thread, the whole thing will unravel. And so drawing on emotional experience to write this novel, I had to learn how to reflect on things that I've lived rather than relive it,
mm-hmm.
because that would just be a mess,
yeah.
and be really damaging. So it was fiction, writing fiction gave me, I think, the mechanism to reflect and reform these memories and experiences rather than reliving them and constantly being stuck in these cycles of the past.
So a memoir would have been a disaster.
I really didn't want to write a memoir.
So when writing fiction, it's like having it's like you're taking the past and turning it into a kind of a building block,
yeah.
which you can then turn in three degrees, 360 degrees, and look at it,
yeah.
With an objective eye to see if it actually fits into the thing you're creating.
Yes.
Does that give you distance from it? Does that give
Absolutely.
You a new perspective?
There were lots of times when, because this is the first time I'd ever written a novel, apart from like the Russian sagas that I was writing when I was like 14.
Soon to be published.
Yeah, because this is my like first experience at doing it, I would constantly pull myself up. I would notice where the story would dry up and it would stop flowing, and it would be when I got too close to the bone, or I drifted too far away from Alice's world and from fiction, not even on the page, just inside myself.
Mm-hmm.
And that would bring me again back to reflecting rather than reliving.
Yeah.
And I had an amazing support network around me. And I'd done a lot of research into this concept. So I had sort of these giants on my bookshelf sort of encouraging me through it from their work. There was like that standing on the shoulders mm-hmm. thing, you yeah. know. And Tom Spanbauer, the American novelist, his work around dangerous writing was really heartening to me. It was about... It's about this idea of going into the sore place that we all have because we're human and we're going to hurt. And writing from there, using fiction as the lie, if you like, the make-believe, to tell the truth truest.
Yeah.
Because it's emotionally true. It's emotional truth. And that was really compelling to me.
Yeah, it comes through in the book. I mean, it's...
Oh, thank you.
Well, that truth and that... Honesty is so important to this book.
Yeah.
I mean, it's kind of the little heartbeat that goes right through it. What role did maturity have in this as well? Because, you know, one of the things that happens is often when terrible things happen to us, we're not an equal to the person who's doing it. And older you get, the more you become yourself and the more confidence people get and more maturity. Did you feel that as... Because, you know, 34... to sit down and start writing, you know, for some people it's quite late, some people it's really early.
There are
other writers who start in their 50s and 60s who have done life and they're finally going to get down to this.
Yeah.
But did you feel that you, by that process of experience and maturity and finding yourself, that you were able to look at this straight?
Yeah, I couldn't have written this any sooner. I couldn't have written this book any sooner, and I think any book that I might have tried to have written that wasn't this one wouldn't have come from the same place, and so wouldn't have maybe had the same power or been the same sort of level of storytelling. And Alice Hoffman said something once again that gave me courage. I had so many authors like this, and she talked about her experience having breast cancer. And she had to wait until it was behind her to even be able to think about writing about it. And that made so much sense to me, that it was scary enough, like being brave enough to look at the past. And that was with the certainty and knowing that it was behind me.
Mm-hmm.
And I couldn't have written this. I think the maturity is, you know, I'd done the work. I'd moved my life onwards, and I couldn't have written this book any sooner than I did. Yeah.
And in it, after So it starts on the coast of, and then moves inland, but then it moves inland.
Yeah.
You've had some experience. You lived out there in the outback Australia. Where were you?
Yeah. I was a ranger at Uluru Kadajuta National Park, and I went out there in my 20s, and I was the senior media officer for the park. So I looked after all the commercial film and photography crews that came out there. And I went out there, I sort of followed a friend who got a job at the resort, and I'd been backpacking in Canada and came home to the Gold Coast and nothing had changed. And I was too broke to go, overseas again. So I went inland, and it was a transformative experience to see that part of our country.
And how much of that is reflected in that part of the book? I mean,
like emotionally and particularly senses, like sensory sort of depiction. I don't think I could have written about it if I, you know, as anybody I think would say, you don't know what that place is like until you go and feel it for yourself.
But even in the book, the Aboriginal culture, they're sort of referring to it and saying that people aren't understanding it.
Mm.
You're writing from a perspective of a white woman from Queensland going out into there. Do you feel there's all these things about permission and that do you feel because of the relationships you've built out there that there's more of a sort of a sense of permission to talk about these kind of things?
I think it had a lot to do with the job that I had as well. Mm-hmm. Being the senior media officer at the park, I had a set of Commonwealth legislation guidelines that people needed to adhere to in order to come out and do any commercial media in the park. And I had really wonderful opportunities and experiences to learn about the stories in the landscapes and the landscapes in stories and what's public and what's not and what's men's business and what's women's business. And so the reason why I had to set, for me, the reason why I had to set the central desert part of Lost Flowers in a totally fictional landscape is because to set it anywhere that actually exists would be to tell stories that are not mine to tell. Yeah. And that's why it was really important to me to fictionalise it and be able to describe the place and the people without telling stories that are not mine.
And this leads into the wildflowers themselves.
Mm.
Is this something that you grew up with or something you've found an interest in and just devoured?
A bit of both.
Yeah.
But devoured is, you know, John, devoured is the right word. I grew up in women's gardens. Granny, my mum's mum, when I was about four, she and my granddad lived in a big Queenslander up in Gladstone, and along the side of the house, she had what was known in our quite large family as the fairy garden. And so Granny would, you know, in famine and, you know, feast and famine sort of weather-wise, there would always be this blooming, lush, gorgeous garden.
Is that natives or not?
Both. Yeah. There would be natives and then there would be sort of introduced flowers. And she would take us, all of us grandkids, and I spent hours in there with her. And it was always revered. Like there was a sense of reverence going into that alley of garden. And she would take me in there and looking back on it as an adult, there was always a purpose to it to teach us and for us to learn about what's at work when you're in the force of nature.
Yeah.
And then growing up, you know, with my mum took to her garden, I think, as well for survival. Like, you know, Granny was a farmer's wife, so it was a hard life, but the garden was always sort of in bloom and meticulous, and my mum was the same. And so growing up with these women's gardens and that lineage in my family, it sort of was always a reminder of what Australian natives can survive and be so beautiful and unique under such, you know, extreme conditions. Mm. And so that's sort of always been just, you know, the culture of my background and my life. And when I was in England, maybe 5 or 6 years ago, and I discovered this Victorian language of flowers where people spoke in flowers, and my brain just melted. I just remember like learning about this and then learning about how popular it was And in a culture, Victorian England times, where people were quite emotionally closed, you would send these elaborate messages via flowers to confess and express the most extreme and sort of pertinent emotional sentiments. And that just drove me, that just drove my imagination mad. And then I just really, really wanted, there's so much, you know, our cultural landscape is so English. Mm. And I really, one of the reasons why I wanted to be an author when I was three was Mae Gibbs and Snugglepot and Cuddlepie, being able to see Mum's garden.
All those nude bums.
And all the nude bums, and being able to wear gum leaves and you know, gum nuts as hats and, and, you know, riding on the wings of kookaburras and stuff. I loved seeing the world that I grew up in reflected in
terrifying Banksy men.
That still to this day. Yeah. Still to the traumatic. Still to this day. I'm so with you there. In Lost Flowers, they mean, you know, I am your captive. Yeah. Yeah, that's deliberate.
Does the language of flowers tie into Hamlet's Ophelia? You know, Ophelia wanders around in that horrible scene with,
yeah, with all the flowers. Yeah. I mean, this is the thing, like, once you start unpacking your imagination, like, what's influenced me, maybe, not in any conscious way, but that again is like flowers have always been symbolic and have always been so evocative.
Mm.
And I think one of the ways that I managed writing through the parts of this novel that just left me depleted some days was the sense of wonder that looking at Australian natives and reading about them and what their habitats alike and that sort of thing, and then assigning meaning to them. Like, such an honour to make up a language assigned to Australian native flowers.
Well, you are making up language because on your Instagram or Twitter or one of the ones, you're talking about Slovakian.
Oh my God, that was just...
adding words to Slovakian language.
I know, that's still mind-blowing. My Slovakian translator and I had a little bit of contact to clarify the names of some of the Australian flowers in the novel, and I was just thanking her for her time and translating, you know, because there's, I can't imagine what it's like translating some of the Australian slang in the book into Slovakian. And she just, you know, of her own generosity of spirit, just replied and said, "You have nothing to thank me for. It's been such a pleasure. By the way, your editor and I, we couldn't find any Slovakian translation words for the Australian names, like the names of these plants. So we had to go to the Slovakian Academy of Sciences, and they went through all of the mentioned flora in the novel. There's about 60 plants and flowers, and they have made up new Slovakian language."
That's brilliant.
Utterly speechless.
Yeah.
Utterly speechless.
And am I right in saying that most of this book was written when you were in the UK?
The whole first draft was written in the UK.
I have the pleasure of speaking to Monica McInerney, who does a lot of, you know, her books are set in Australia and she's writing from afar.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's over the years, you know, Christina Stead wrote from overseas and wrote amazing novels set in Sydney. And even her most famous book, which was meant to be set in Washington, is certainly set, if you just scrape the surface, it's in Sydney.
Yeah.
What is it like writing about Australia from afar? Does it heighten? Like, are you sort of obsessing about details?
Yeah. It was really, I've been thinking about this a lot lately, sort of reflecting. I had this whole routine and rhythm to my daily writing practice because I had to write every day so I didn't lose my nerve.
Yeah.
And even when I was writing utter crap, because the first drafts always are so bad. Well, mine are. Anyway, well, mine was. I've only done it once. But so not to lose my nerve, I would make sure that I did it every day. And writing about the heat and the humidity and the tropical flora of Australia, and even sort of the bush where Thornfield is, the flower farm, and then further inland, going back to the desert, it was this real conjuring of my senses and remembering, because I would wake up before the sun came up in Manchester, where I spend most of my year. And so it would be dark and cold icicles on the window. And so I had this whole routine. I would go downstairs in my UGG boots that I've had since I was 23 that still survive and have red dirt in them still from my life in the desert. And I'd make a big sort of bucket of coffee, go back upstairs, and I would have lots of sensory things that would sort of, I don't know, sort of click my mind into gear. So I would burn Australian eucalyptus oil in my oil burner at my desk. And I had a couple of seed pods from the desert that I'd sort of run through my, like over my palms, just to remember that. And sort of all of a sudden, it, that veil would come back in the imagination, and I could kind of write from there, almost like I was doing it with my eyes closed.
Yeah.
And draw from that place.
It's astonishing, the mind. I mean,
isn't it?
When people talk to me about how do you remember such things, I go, oh, I don't. If you ask me now, I have no idea.
I have no idea.
But when I'm in the writing phase, it's a completely different story.
Something, and you don't know what it is. It's like a process that you're unaware of. You're kind of the last one to know, really.
Yeah.
And so then when I was sort of reflecting on it, and I wrote about it a little bit a while ago, and it sort of felt like, When I wrote about it, I equated it to sort of taking your shoes off before you go into a temple.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that process of lighting the candle with the drops of eucalyptus oil, and outside it's like it was damp, and it's like Bronte country.
Yeah.
And inside in that little square space of my office, I was sort of in Queensland in the Northern Territory. It was really magic.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for coming in. But also, thank you so much for taking the time to write the book, because we're all loving it.
Oh,
and
thank
Australia's
you, John.
Australia's going to embrace it. I mean, the rest of the world's embraced it. It's gone to 20 other countries. It's been sold. It's an extraordinary success.
Thank you.
And HarperCollins has done an extraordinary cover.
Haven't they?
Just amazing.
I just want to wear it or eat it.
People are just going to pick this book up in the bookshops and just hold it and hug it.
I'll be in the corner rocking it.
Yeah. Thank you so much for coming
Thank you.
And you can get hold of Holly Rigland's book at booktopia.com.au right now.
Thanks for listening to the Booktopia podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to us on SoundCloud and iTunes. And if your eyeballs need a workout, check us out on YouTube at Booktopia TV. And don't forget, for all books featured on this episode and all episodes of the Booktopia podcast, head to Booktopia, Australia's local bookstore, at www.booktopia.com.au. Thanks for listening.